If I were in charge of creating a financial modeling Hall of Fame, the first three people I would elect are number one, Rand Herr, the creator of Pillar Software, and then Alight Planning. Number two, Kel Hoffman, who created Projected Financials, which was then rebranded to White Birch before it was purchased. And by the way, Projected Financials, way, way, way ahead of its time when it debuted. And then finally, a guy maybe you've not heard of, Steve Bailey. Now, I've known Steve since about 2008 and his writing in the Quantrix Modeler Forum. I also got to meet him in person in 2018 at a Quantrix annual event in Maine. This guy is a financial modeling genius, and that is our topic today. And by the way, if you are a CEO, we're not going to get too techy. Many parts of this conversation will resonate. I'm Mark Gandy. This is CFO Bookshelf. Our visit with financial modeling expert Steve Bailey is coming up next. When I think about financial modeling, I'm reminded of teenage dating when I was a kid many, many years ago. Everyone talked about it. No one, I mean, no one did it right. And so that was my first question for Steve. We talk about modeling, but do most business people, do we really get it?
Yeah, it's true because I think it has to do with the perception of skill sets. I work in a lot of different FP&A groups and with accountants and so forth. And I think there's an idea that if you're a financial person or an accountant or something, you sort of intuitively know how to build models. And what we find a lot, besides the normal just problems with mistakes and errors and so forth, it's just fundamental design questions. So, you know, when we're building models in my company, of course, we're looking to build a model that's robust and extendable, and basically you don't have to go in and crack the logic open every time you want to add a new product or a new line of business or something. And there's a lot of techniques that we use to do that. We also leverage a database a lot more than you would if you're using a spreadsheet type tool that doesn't write to database. They read okay. They just don't write, which, you know, when we're able to write, opens up a lot of possibilities for us, as well as creating multiple versions of plans, multiple, scenarios, if you will, and then provide those to the database so they can be, you know, some visualization tool can use them. So, but yeah, I think the fundamental premise though is correct that people still, there's still a lot of folks out there building financial models that they may be subject matter experts in their industry and the nuances of finance, but when it comes down to actually building the model that would withstand the test of time and the rigors of like scenarios and repeatable type processes, that's, I think, where the modeler comes forward to build those models as opposed to, you know, deep subject matter expertise.
You brought up an interesting point at the very beginning. I've mentioned this on my Twitter account a couple of times. I never get pushback on it, but I'm not convinced that accountants should be the people who should be modeling. Now, I know you have an accounting finance background, but just because you're an accountant doesn't mean, oh, I am the modeler in the company. Do you get right?
So here's an interesting thing that we've been getting a little bit more involved in is this concept of when you're modeling between modeling the accounting values versus the economic values. So a lot of modelers will build financial models so that they can reconcile those financial models to the accounting records after the accounting's done with all the things that you do as an accountant. But the true economics of some of the decisions, and I mean, the most obvious one is the difference between cash and accrual, but there are other subtleties in there about how allocations are made and things of that nature that really can skew the true economics as opposed to just getting the accounting correct. And so what we're starting to do more of is building models that have both values in them. So you can jump back and forth and say, ah, so this is how it related to the actuals, but this is the sort of the values we should be building our decisions on. And the economics, sort of the accounting sort of falls out of that.
I was so excited to be able to talk about this topic, especially with you. I said this in email in private. There are three people on the planet I would love to have a conversation with about driver-based modeling, and you're in that list of three. So here's a very extremely strong opinion. I'm not going to call it a fact, but a very strong opinion. I think the best way for any CEO, any CMO, any COO, the janitor, the head of admin, the best way to learn how a business functions is to see it in the form of a model. Do you agree with that opinion?
Yeah, I do, because you're going to touch on all areas of the company. I mean, so we regularly have subject matter experts we work with on the operations side, the accounting side, the HR side. So when we're building these large integrated business planning models, you know, we're interfacing with a lot of different folks and trying to capture their way of seeing the world within those models. You know, I have folks at work for me, and one of them, she's, as a consultant to this company, I dare say she probably is one of the few people in the company that has a full view of all aspects of the operation and the interdependencies and interaction between those different parts of the company. It's a large manufacturing organization. So I agree with you, because, you know, when we sit in meetings, she's the one that answers a lot of questions about what's what and who's doing what and what part of the company and what that means to the sort of, you know, overarching models that we've put together for them.
I first encountered you, as we said in the intro, you were working at Quanterix at the time up in Maine, one of the most beautiful parts of the United States. And a lot of your forum entries, comments, I'm just thinking this guy, his tacit knowledge, it's just incredible. I'm going to guess that many moons ago, you were tasked to do some type of a model, and you're probably doing it in whether it's Excel, Symfony, or QuattroPro, whatever it was back in the 90s or whenever you started. I bet you got hooked.
Yeah.
And then you wanted more. Is that kind of your origin story of how you got into the modeling? What was your first really cool model that you did?
You're not going to believe this. So before I was an accountant, I was a police officer. And
you were a police officer?
Yeah. That's cool. Well, I got done with police work and went into public accounting. I was a cop with a calculator at that point. But before I left left police work, the first real, I hadn't given it any thought until you just asked me this question, but I started, you know, the first model I really, really sunk my teeth in, and it was in Excel, was sort of evaluating police officers' performance relative to the data that they were capturing in the systems of the day. So, you know, how many hours they're on duty, how many, you know, traffic enforcement encounters they have, and whether they had a ticket or not wasn't really what we were up to. It's just like, you know, how busy are they? And what types of tasks are different folks getting involved in? And that whole model, actually, I was blessed that the police chief at the time supported the idea. And he actually took it to the Police Chiefs Association conference in Seattle. This would have been in, I don't know, 95, something like that. And but of course, it was, I like to think I was way ahead of my time on that, but I think it also was very disturbing for some folks as well. But that was probably the first model I got into making, and I wasn't even an accountant or a numbers guy at the time. I was just intrigued with that notion. And then I think the fires were really lit working on my bachelor's degree. I ended up taking a bunch of math courses and really got into that aspect of it as well. One of which was some programming, and, you know, I guess the rest is history at that point.
So you've been modeling for more than 20 some odd years. Is there one model? Is there one model that just sticks out that this is like art? This is the Picasso. This is my Picasso painting. Can you think of one?
You know, I can think of one that is intriguing to me because it was non-financial. And that, again, is something unusual for us type of folks. It actually designed or created document retention plans for multinational companies around the world that if you're in Thailand and you have HR records but you have a firing, what do you do? So it was completely non-financial. It was really just modeling behaviors of documents. And I worked with one of the world-leading experts on document retention. He read all the laws, which I couldn't do. I think I'd rather put pins in my eyes than to do that. But he was really a great guy. And that model lasted years and years. And one of those seminars that you came to, I'm starting to teach, and he's sitting in front of me, and I hadn't seen him in 10 years. And I'm like, "What you're?" He goes, "Yeah, we're still using it." I'm like, "Holy cow, that's fantastic." But, you know, the sort of the model of my life, I don't know if I found it yet, but I think a couple good candidates include one I did for a university overseas. That was a really complex model that we did for this university. I spent a lot of time in Singapore working on it. So that was a really good one. Another one that I probably think is right up there is for a medical equipment manufacturer. That was a good one. Had a lot of one of the nuances that is when you're dealing in medical insurance arena, you've got four people that pay potentially your primary, secondary, and tertiary insurance, and then finally, you know, the patient might pay something. So, or pay portions. So, you know, modeling that had some real interesting flavors to it. And I've done so many, you know, you name an industry, I've created a model for it probably. Solar, I really, really enjoyed solar. If you fly out to Nevada and you look to the southwest, southeast as you're coming in, you'll see a solar power plant out there called Nevada Solar One. I don't know if that's what they call it anymore, but that's what they called it at that time. And I built the model for that. That was really cool. And I now have another solar model in the works for another company. So that's, you know, kind of coming back around to me again. So that's cool. So those are probably three that jump right out.
And by the way, Steve, if you were asking me what is the model of my life, I would say her name is Mrs. G, and we've been married for 37 years. I just had to say that.
Now you just threw me under the bus. So
No, I did not. I could not help that.
Yeah, hey, I want to talk about my wife. Listen to this now.
I want to talk about some big ideas in the world of want to talk about financial modeling or driver-based modeling. I want to talk about some topics that usually don't get talked about in this conversation. So, and I thought, let's have some fun with this, but systems thinking versus component thinking. Now, even though I've given you an interview arc in advance, I've not prepped you for this. So in the concept or the construct of modeling, whether it's financial modeling or just general driver-based models, where do you think I'm coming from? Where do you think this is headed when I bring up the topic systems versus component thinking?
Well, if I had to take a crack at it, I would say I generally think more along the system. And when I'm thinking system in the totality of the problem, right? I mean, you can't model in isolation. So I got a good example right now, and you stop me if I'm headed down the wrong path on this question.
No, I already knew you'd nail this. Keep going.
So, you know, we've done some big models, and there's this one part of the organization was disconnected from the financial planning, and those financial plans include sort of volumes and activities, and they were disconnected, so they had their plan, which had no connection to the financial plan. So we've been working to tie that all together so that and it's hundreds of millions of dollars of disconnect. So there's real value in saying, if we change the financial plan, does it make sense relative to all the other things that have to go on? Now, I got another client right now, too, that we're working with that, they have capacity, a lot of capacity constraints, and one of the unique ones is skilled labor, labor skills, rather. So they have people who can do some things, but not all things, and it's very important in their industry that the right people are sort of doing the work, because otherwise the wrong people could possibly kill their customers. So, but that had to be connected with the financial people saying, hey, we've got a strategy. We want to grow the company by X amount. Well, that's wonderful. But the, you know, maybe the operation guys were saying, well, no, or, you know, there are implications to those decisions beyond just a few CapEx projects. So I tend to be more thinking in system, but what I find, though, is the entry point for people is more modular. They have a very specific problem on their hand. We need to model our receivables better. We need to model something else. And it's that point when in talking with them, is like, yeah, but who else uses this information? How do we synchronize your organization? And that was a term that one of my clients' executives said in a meeting, that he sat back and he goes, now I can synchronize the planning in this organization, because everybody's sort of working off the drivers into those decisions. And I found over time that, you know, you boil it down in most companies, there's only a couple drivers from which everybody else sort of comes off of. You know, the most obvious one is some sort of sales plan, right? If we want to sell 10,000 gadgets this month, you know, yeah, we can put a financial statement together on that, but that doesn't mean our warehouse can handle it, our procurement can handle it, our operations can handle it. You know, can we even sell it to the customers? You know, are there 10,000 gadgets out there that can be sold? What do we need to do to find new customers and new customer classes? Is this going to be distribution, warehouse, big box, whatever? So, I'm definitely... My focus when I start talking to folks about modeling is, yeah, we'll solve the immediate need, and then we build in modules. So we build with the notion, because as you're well aware, we build with multidimensional modeling tool as opposed to rows and columns. So snapping together a bunch of modules across common dimensions within the organization makes it very easy to take that approach.
One of my all-time favorite books is a book by C.S. Lewis. It's called The Great Divorce. Love the book. I would go so far as to say every consultant, anyone who works in consulting with other people, should read the book. There's a section of the book where there's an artist up in, I don't know if it's purgatory or heaven, but he's talking to a spirit. So this artist used to be someone who just loved painting the landscape. He loved painting light. He painted the way he saw it so other people could see the glimpses of what he could see. But he makes a quote talking to the spirit, because the spirit says, I think you've lost your way, buddy. He goes on to say, one becomes more and more interested in paint for its own sake. This is an observation that I've had. Push back if you want to. Sometimes I sense that some people get more focused on the tool or the paint instead of the outcome. Now, you don't just model. You've been a mentor. You help other people. I mean, you have to deploy models and transfer them. You have to hand them off. Do you find sometimes that modelers become more interested in the tool as opposed to...
I mean, it's funny. My phrase I use, like when I was a child, I thought like a child, right? And when I was a young modeler, I thought it would be cool if I could write one formula. I thought that was elegance, was to write one formula and see how much I could get to do with it. And I've kind of pulled back away from that, because even though there were a few formulas, they became, you know, it became an art form in itself to try to do that. It became unmanageable to try to teach somebody or show somebody what this is doing. So I've kind of broken it down, and I do get a little less connected from the tool. It allows me to do things that I don't think anybody else can do, unless, you know, I now think more about the, as you said earlier, the system, the really long-term view of how we can use the tool to accomplish something, you know, sort of kind of beautiful from our perspective, right? I mean, I don't know if something like my wife would say what we do is beautiful, but I see the elegance in it. And so things like the database, things like using, you know, some of these really advanced, cool data visualization tools and not trying to make everything in the single tool that you're using. So, I would tend to agree with that. We've taken apart some horrendous spreadsheets over the years. The first clue to me that the company has a big, gigantic problem on their hands is the word guru comes out followed by macro. And that's usually the recipe for finding yourself in a really bad situation someday. You shouldn't have too many gurus, in the sense that the tool has gotten so sophisticated and so complex that only a handful of people can actually understand what's really going on inside there. So I probably went off on a tangent on you.
No, you did not. This is good stuff. I want to throw out another big idea before we get into some other concepts. For close to 10 years, I was a board member of a financial institution. So we talked about stress testing all the time. And even though I was modeling at the time, the concept of stress testing never stuck. But then I read the book Stress Testing by Timothy Geithner. And I'm thinking, holy bleep, this is it. Why am I building models with best case scenario, likely scenario, worst case scenario? Why don't I just take some of these levers that you talked about earlier? Why don't I just play around with these instead of having different scenarios? Now, if we want to have scenarios, you know, let's come up with a story, a very specific story. But the concept of stress testing, even in the FP&A world, I don't see that concept written about very often. Is that a focus for you?
You know, I still think I'm being asked a lot by folks for the scenario idea. I feel like there's more people asking for models that handle scenarios than maybe 10 years ago, where they built budget and that was what they wanted, or a forecast. But now I'm seeing more interest in variants of budgets and variants of forecasts. But personally, I'd love to get involved with an organization and I don't remember where this came from. This was a long time ago. I probably don't even have the name right, but it was this notion of like emergent budgeting forecasting, where you make plans and as the year evolves, you start figuring out which one is materializing. Like, here's a good example, like the pandemic. You know, if you had five plans on your shelf at the beginning of, say, 2020, when you probably made those plans in October or November of 19, as 2020 starts to evolve, you already have sort of that fork in the road you can take very quickly and say, okay, this is the scenario we didn't want to do, but it looks like the scenario that's materializing. But we already know from this plan, we've already kind of thought through some of the things that we might need to do with that type of plan emerging. I'd like to see more of that. It's tough. I mean, people, you know, all kinds of things hinge off of how good you did the budget, even though budget is usually obsolete the moment it's published. So, you know, if you think about the world today, you know, if you build a budget in September or October, by February, you know, it's like, okay, well, that was an exercise that we did, but, you know, the world is changing. So being able to be very fleet of foot and have some prepared pathways that you can take, I think, is an interesting way to look at that whole process of planning.
If a chief executive officer, any industry, doesn't matter, if they had lunch with you, and if he says, Steve, what is driver-based modeling?
Well, I think we touched upon it a little bit. I mean, you identify those things in your organization that are kind of the key sort of launching point for everybody. But, you know, then you kind of keep continuing breaking that down. I think you've got a bunch of drivers all the way down. Like in some of the modeling I've done, you know, I auto-generate FTEs in certain roles because of activities that are occurring somewhere else in the model. So, you know, that way you're as you're moving the big levers up top, all of the little drivers down below are driving, you know, the extra things that you're going to need, whether you're going to need more square footage, whether you're going to need more people in certain roles in certain areas of the business, whether you're going to, you know, you need more material, whatever it is, you know, those drivers are sort of, in my mind, you kind of, you got a couple at the top and then they kind of break apart as you go down deeper and deeper into the model. I think it probably hinges back to, you know, activity-based costing that some folks were all hot about some years ago.
I know you are hired to create models from start to finish, but I have a feeling you have observed maybe someone's taken a stab at a model and they just got stuck. And then that's where you come in and you probably start on a blank, start with a blank canvas. But if some of the models you looked at over the years, and I know you've worked with some younger people as well in other positions, what are some of the common, I don't want to call them errors, but common issues or shortcomings that you see?
The number one problem with models that we come across is order of operations. It's followed secondly by bad references, believe it or not. You know, there's always that thing that floats around every so often about what is this simple equation? What is it equal to? And you get like five different answers and it's just arithmetic. And, so that's always good. You know, we like to find those things because I think it adds value to what we're doing. Not only are we building a model for these folks, but we're also sort of in a sort of backhanded way validating what they were using in the past. That's probably two of the quick ones. But I think one of the things that – and I think it's the nature of the tools that folks are using. And I think it comes out very clear early on and a little bit startling to folks when we get into the modeling businesses. Most people start with the presentation in mind. What do they want it to look like when they're done? And some of that, like I said, is the tool they're choosing to use. But I go in and we don't even care about data. We don't care about logic early on. We're just trying to extract from them the dimensions of the organization, because those are fundamentals. You know, if you have cost centers and you have products and product families and you have lines of business and you have various time dimensions, and not all time dimensions are the same. I think that's probably one that we uncover is like, I'm going to build a model that has 12 months and 5 years in it. Well, that gets really challenging when you start a fixed asset and put it into service in June, and it's going to be a 7-year useful life. You know, that is probably a place we find a lot of problems with modelers, is that they're working from a presentation versus structural perspective. And then what we do is, you know, when we're all done and the model is cranking out the numbers, then we go in and say, okay, now what do you really want those numbers to look like? And in the process, it's always 90%. I don't know what that number is, but it's fairly common. You go, oh, and by the way, isn't this the way your database is organized? So let's just stick this future data that you never had before into the database that aligns structurally with your historical data. And now guess what happens is your visualization tools can move seamlessly between actuals and forecasts and put a lot more stuff into context for you, rather than actuals have this sort of high fidelity visualization, and then you get a PowerPoint that has the future, you know. So I think that would be my short answer to that question.
Do you ever find some people getting too much detail in the model versus
all the time?
I thought that might be a prominent one.
Yeah. So, matter of fact, we recently had one, you know, looking at a 5-year model and planning SKU levels. And I actually had a prospective client that was in the tobacco industry, and they wanted to forecast down to the cigarette package SKU. And we're like, it's in a lot of folks want to do customers because that's who they know today. And it's like, 5 years from now, you may not have Walmart, but you'll have Target. So why don't we just call it big box store or something or something like that and just plan accordingly. And you can plan your growth in that area as well. It's like if we want to grow 30% in that area, we've got five customers. We don't know who the sixth and seventh customer is that's going to get us there, but we know we got to, better get on it. It's like when the sun comes up in Africa, you better be running. So that would be one of those cases where I think getting into the minutiae of customers and SKUs tends to mask the real thing you're trying to accomplish.
I would say 90% of my models, I have a what's called a unit rate amount structure. Now, I plagiarized that from a tool called Alight Planning that's no longer on the market. It's actually been rebranded. So I use that structure in all of my models. Some people would say, yeah, that's driver-based modeling. You're taking units times rate. And I say, no, that's just a formula. Your drivers start to occur when you have the drivers to those units, and then you may have a driver below it. Is it also possible that maybe you don't have enough drivers? Again, I'm not saying more detail like your situation, but I just think of a great case of sales. Sales takes so many leads, and then so many leads take so many of, maybe website presence, or I would assume that is an issue as well. Maybe getting not just the right amount of drivers, but the right amount of levels of drivers.
Yeah. Yeah. We got one right now that's really cool. It's a, you'd recognize it in the healthcare industry. They start with, how many clicks you get on a website, and that just sort of drives and how much you're planning to spend. That's all kind of the drivers. If we spend $1 million, we expect to get so many clicks. Of those clicks, so many will become this, and then of those, how many will become, and you just kind of keep boiling down that pyramid using those drivers to eventually get to the unit, the quantity level. That's pretty common. But when you were talking, what I was thinking about was looking into the unit and looking at into the let's just say the cost of goods sold side of that unit and all of the drivers that could go into that. We do a lot of modeling with some high level bill of materials stuff. So, for example, if what's the impact is one of your raw materials goes through the roof, and does it have as big of an, it could go up 200%, but is it a big driver? Into your true costs, right? How much can you absorb in there? When does the red light come on or the alarm go off that says that price is now becoming, here's my accountant piece of me, becoming material in the materials, right? So I was kind of thinking along those lines as you were speaking, but also, that whole sales funnel type approach as well.
I want to give you a standing ovation for something that occurred years ago. Again, we mentioned Quantrix a few minutes ago, and you were working for them as one of their internal consultants. I don't remember your exact title, but you had, I think it was you that created this, Steve, correct me if I'm mistaken. It was a one-page document. It was a framework, but it was basically how a model should be structured. And in my opinion, you've done one of the best jobs of explaining how a model should be documented. Now, there are a lot of great modeling courses in cyberspace, and we don't have time to mention all of them. But I don't think I've ever come across anyone who's taught, here is how you document a model. That is important. Now, I'm leading the witness. I know that. But again, just kudos to your work in documentation. It's critical, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've been blessed to have a tool that makes that documentation a lot easier. I mean, I have clients asking me all the time, do we get a manual? No, it's pretty much self-documented in the model, so you don't need a manual. But I think I know what you're referring to, and I've kind of stepped away. I've enhanced that with what I kind of now talk about as the five-layer design pattern. And I think it's an interesting way to look at building models as a pattern that you follow. Because I think a lot of folks just start with an empty slate and throw some stuff on it and then start moving it around and see if they can get it to come out where they want it to. But with this five-layer design pattern, you know, it's a very structured approach. And it makes it a lot easier to start with a single cell and build out the model very rapidly and very consistently. And that design pattern became the fundamental sort of piece of the story where we went into our, you know, we started offering modeling as a service where we can build models very quickly and very efficiently for clients and take over sort of the modeling piece of it. Because I think the first comment you made earlier on about, you know, about the skill sets, you know, just because you're an accountant doesn't make you a modeler, but does make you a subject matter expert in accounting in that organization. So our position was, well, you know, we can certainly build the models the way you need them to be and bring in all, you know, all the experience from other industries and other clients building models for them as well. So anyway, thank you for that plug there for some work I did back in probably 2007.
That sounds right.
I've evolved it over the last couple, 3 years now. I've revisited it.
Let's back up the truck. Before we talk about modeling as a service, do we get to hear what these five design layers are? Or is that proprietary?
No, it's going to sound vaguely familiar, if not completely familiar. So from our perspective, we model in this approach. It's structure, logic, data, presentation, and security. So the first thing we're going to look at when we start modeling is what are the structures, what are the dimensionalities that are going on here, and how are those best organized? So we have some tools that say, okay, the first step is identify all of these dimensions, and then the second step is starting to put those dimensions, because they're either related or in a relationship with each other, which basically, sort of stubs out the framework for what comes next, and that's your logic, where you begin to, you know, do the math, and it becomes a lot simpler and a lot easier to follow in that way. And then, of course, we bring in, you know, all of the data later. I know my New England accent is slipping here, but so we can bring that in later and expand the model. And then at that point, you say, okay, now I've got all the structure, I've got all the logic, I've got all the computations, the model is producing the right answer. Now, the presentation is, I need bits and pieces of that put together in different ways on dashboards and so forth, and provide some folks with different pieces of that model than some other folks. So that's the security layer. When you're working with a spreadsheet, there is no security. You really have a choice of, I put it in a folder that only certain people can get to, or I put a password on it, which, by the way, you can crack with software, because I've had to do that because clients have given me password protected files that they've lost the passwords for. So a lot of the model building goes in the opposite direction of that five-layer design pattern. And that's what I found was, turning it on its head made it a lot easier to build these models. Because, like I said, in Excel, you do security, which usually isn't much of a decision. Presentation is what you're really working with. You throw all the data in there because without the data, you have no idea where to put the formulas. Then you do the formulas, and then you realize, oops, I've got another dimension here. So you make a copy of the worksheet and create a second worksheet, and then you create a summary worksheet, and now your model has gotten exponentially more complicated. So we kind of come at it the opposite direction.
Let's promo the heck out of your current firm. Let's just go, let's just go all out. Sure. Tell us about your current firm. And what is modeling as a service? That I think that's brilliant. So let's start with the first.
Yeah, so I've been involved in, you know, model building for, I think you kind of, 20 some odd years or more now. I don't know when my official day of start was, but I've always enjoyed working with my clients. I've always been involved in different industries. Makes me a lot of fun at cocktail parties. I was at one last Saturday night and was talking to somebody in the railroad industry. And so, you know, I was lucky I had some experience in that area with railroad and intermodal stuff. But at any rate, so I've been doing this, and I had a company before, was Foreside Group, and that was really geared towards just client service. We've created model metrics. Last year, I brought a gentleman in, a former Quantrics person as well. He's not a modeler. He's on the market sales and marketing side of things. But we wanted to expand Quantrics modeling, or the modeling that we do using the Quantrics tool, because to date, it's still the best tool I've found to do what I do. I'm not a pitch man for Quantrics. But so we looked at the industry and what was going on, and we decided that, you know, modeling as a service was maybe an answer to some folks who want to do better modeling, but they don't have time. You know, it takes time to make time, and they don't have time to learn a new tool, to learn a new skill, to learn a new approach like the 5-layer design pattern, especially if they've been doing it for a long time. They've kind of fall back into their old habits. So, you know, modeling as a service is, you know, we can build these models very quickly. We can serve them up on a platform that allows you and others to interact with them. We'll take care of the maintenance, so we'll add the enhancement features as part of your service. We can, you know, manage the platform for you. We're a partner with you in your modeling, and leave your subject matter experts to what they should be doing, and that is looking at the results of these models and making informed decisions rather than, you know, spending their day trying to figure out A13 plus B54 is supposed to represent. So we take over the whole modeling for folks, and get them on a place where going forward they can not only have the models they need today, but also, as we mentioned earlier, it's structured up correctly for that next layer to get towards more of the system approach as opposed to the modular approach. So that's what we're up to currently in terms of the modeling side. We've got an other initiative going on with some software, but it's not ready for prime time yet.
I know that anyone who can walk, talk, breathe, and write a check could probably be a client, but is there a particularly ideal client that you like to work with?
Yeah, I love the working with the clients who are at that point of inflection in their company where they've gone from to a point where they say, in order to get to the next level, we need another level of sophistication. And, you know, I'm not saying that we are the highest sophisticated approach, but it's certainly one where they're saying, you know, something isn't right, and they're looking to build upon, you know, some skills that we offer, and, you know, very, you know, interested in how to take the business to the next level and set them up for, you know, the next 5 years of growth and planning and whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish, problems they're trying to solve. So those are to me, and it doesn't matter whether they're $5 million company or $125 billion company. And I've worked with all of them in that range. That's not really the key to me is, you know, the size of the company. Matter of fact, sometimes they get really, really big. It's sometimes harder because it's nice to work with the the owner, right? There's no committee decision to be made. It's like, this is what I want and I'm going to get it. So, but no, I think those are the best clients for me. And the industries, I love manufacturing. I love solar, you know, what we would call variable energy, as opposed to, you know, those other types of forms of the, you know, green energy, it's all variable. But those types of things, those two industries are interesting to me as well.
Let's take a very simple professional services firm maybe doing $25 million or less. Can I be nosy? What might this cost them over time? It's nice that they're not just paying for one project. It's again, it's ongoing. It's like a subscription model. Is the pricing, would you say, friendly? I mean, again, can I ask that question?
Sure. It's, I guess friendly is always a matter of perspective. You know, if we're building a model that has, let's just take this current one I've got. It's got manufacturing, pretty complicated manufacturing aspect in it. We probably will build probably 3 weeks, 120 hours, 140, 50 hours of billable hours in there. And then once the model's deployed, it runs about 15% of that. And then whatever number of user licenses you want to access the platform, which they're about $750 a person for a full member, and then $450 for view only type of user. So so I think, you know, a company looking to get a pretty good model out of the gate, they're probably looking in somewhere between the $20,000 and $30,000 range to get the model up. And then probably 10 to keep it going. And then, but what happens is they go, well, can we bolt on this? Can we add that to it? And then I think the value proposition keeps growing at that point, because we're still under FTE. If you think about it from that perspective, if you hire somebody that you think is going to be your modeler, you're 3-6 months in before they really might have something good. If you found somebody who's, and I got my air quotes up, professional modeler, somebody that's done a lot of modeling as opposed to a subject matter expert, you know, you're going to have a FTE, and then of course they're going to be building more models. So, you know, we like to stay within an FTE in terms of that service we're offering, because I think it's easy enough to consume somebody all year to just play, you know, stay on top of these models, especially if they're involved in the month-end processing, month-end closing, quarter close, mm-hmm. and those models have to be hand-cranked every quarter and every month in order to, you know, I got one client, they had 130 spreadsheets that were involved with probably 10 worksheets on each of workbooks, that, you know, 130 workbooks, you know, probably 10 worksheets each, that every month, you know, these folks went through and basically made copies of them all and moved the time dimension out one and fixed the formulas. And then by the time they got done loading it and testing it, they were out of time. And it was wrong. They had a plug. That was a special name for the plug figure. But yeah, that's essentially what they did. You know, that's not value-adding work for somebody. And I also approach it from that perspective is, you know, if you've got a high value SME, is money well spent for them to spend, you know, a third of their time copy paste insert pound ref pull my hair out type work? I don't think so. So our position would be, you know, we build models that don't require that stuff. So it's got to be worth something.
Steve, this has been great. You do need to write a book. And when I met you in 2018 up in Maine, I think there were some rumblings that you had a book in you and just needed the time to do it, but you need to write a book on this topic.
Yeah, I've toyed with that idea over time, but you know, my clients keep me busy, my business keeps me busy. So I really haven't gotten to it. I have some ideas. I've done some outlining and some rough work on it. I always go back and forth between writing a book that's really sort of techie versus something that's a bit more comical and more like a novel. I always like the one it's required reading for anybody in business school. I think it's called The Goal. It's kind of a novel,
exactly,
that explains that. You know, it's the Jimmy John versus the Subway sandwich making thing. And so I thought about writing a book kind of in that sort of approach, but I don't know if I'm that talented, so creative enough. So I kind of set that project aside, but I get asked it a lot for sure.
Well, when you write it, I want to be the first person that gets to interview after you. I'll also buy 20 copies and just start handing them out. Because if you go to, no, I'm serious. If you go to Amazon right now and if you key in driver-based modeling, you're going to come up empty. And most of the books on financial modeling, it's probably going to be an Excel-based book or some workbook. They're just nothing really, and maybe that's just the way it is. It'd be like an accounting book.
I can't take credit for it, but on our website, we have a white paper. It's about 13, 14 pages that we wrote. By Dave Phillips wrote it, but I interviewed me a lot, and plus his own background in it. So we have sort of a condensed version of that for integrated business planning. So if you don't want to read a long-winded novel about from me, that might be the short and quick way of getting some perspective on that.
There are three people on the planet I'd want to talk to about driver-based modeling. You're in that list of three.
Who are the other two? I might want to call them.
The first one may be hard to reach. He's at a season of life where he's in retirement. I've even have asked him to do an interview. I've done a text-based interview on LinkedIn, but he said, Mark, I really don't want to do something on a podcast. His name is Rand Herr. He created the Pillar software, which is then bought by Hyperion, which is then bought by Oracle. So that's kind of a big deal software. When his non-compete expired, and I think it was after that, he created Alight Planning. And Alight Planning, then it morphed into something a little bit bigger, and I think it's been rebranded. The other guy is Kel Hoffman. I found a tool called Project. It was at the time it was called Projected Financials. And when I met Kel, the guy is a brainiac, and I will probably send him the link to this show, so he's going to hear this, and he may turn 10 shades of red. I introduced him to a former Microsoft salesperson that they eventually hired he was on board for a couple of years. But Kel is just a brilliant, I love hearing him speak. He's a great communicator. He speaks very clearly, succinctly. So he's number two. And then you are number three, because I've heard you speak and I've read a lot of your content on those Quantrix forums. And so you belong in that group of three.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Now that's what you call a jam session of two people talking financial modeling. By the way, Steve Bailey, he was talking about a guide on his website. The guide is the Model Metrics Guide to Integrated Business Planning, and it's going to have all of the big ideas from his perspective on integrated and continuous business planning. You can find that at modelmetrics.com, modelmetrics.com. Metrics is M-E-T-R-I-X, not a C, but an X. Again, Steve Bailey, you are amazing. I kid you not. He is, in my opinion, in my estimation, one of the top business and financial modelers in the world. So check out that website if you want to learn more. And I have a feeling if you find him on LinkedIn, he'll be more than happy to accept your connection. And I'm sure he'd be glad to talk shop with you. Hey, that's a wrap. This is CFO Bookshelf. Until next time.